This podcast brought to you by Hope 103.2.
Hello and welcome to the Hope Mornings weekly podcast. I'm Katrina Rowe. Baby Gammy has dominated the headlines this week as his Thai surrogate mother accuses his biological parents of abandoning their son with Down syndrome. There have been many twists and turns to this story, but it's worth asking what's really involved in bringing up a child with Down syndrome. Liz is a single mom of four kids. Her youngest, Lucy, has Down syndrome. She's also had to deal with other complications such as leukemia, celiac disease, and alopecia. On Lucy's fifth birthday, she reflects on the ups and downs of the last 5 years. You might have seen the Arabic letter N appearing on Facebook and Twitter recently. It stands for Nazrani or Nazarene, and it's being sprayed on the homes and businesses of Christians in Iraq. Greg Clark from the Bible Society explains what ISIS are doing to Christians in Iraq and how you can help. How is modern technology affecting our spirituality? We discuss that with the author of iGods, How Technology Shapes Our Spiritual and Social Lives. TV newsreader Suzanne Lattimore shares her son's battle with cancer, what she's learnt through it all, and how it's inspired her to give back. And her sister, Belinda, is taking on a special challenge to raise funds for the Cancer Ward at Westmead Children's Hospital. Finally, our film reviewer, Ben McKechnie, discusses the new romantic comedy And So It Goes, starring Michael Douglas and Diane Keaton. That's all coming up in the Hope Mornings weekly podcast. This week, baby Gammy has captured the heart of a nation. Born with Down syndrome to a surrogate mother in Thailand, the little boy was abandoned by his biological parents, who took home his sister but left behind her disabled brother. The story's had many twists and turns and has raised lots of questions about surrogacy, but the situation is not actually unique to surrogacy. Babies with Down syndrome are also abandoned here in Australia. So what's involved in raising a child with Down syndrome? Can both mother and child live a fulfilling life? Liz is a single mum with four children. Her youngest, Lucy, has Down syndrome. She's also had many associated medical problems, including leukemia, celiac disease, and now alopecia. I caught up with Liz on her daughter's birthday and asked her whether hearing about baby Gammy has had a big impact on her.
It has. I first heard a snippet about it on the radio and just thought, did I hear that right? I was a bit disbelieving at first, and it just made me feel really sad and really wondering where that couple was at. What perhaps did they fear so much that they couldn't take this baby home? I felt really sad, sad for them, what they're going to miss out on, and really sad for his sister and what she is going to miss out on. I asked one of my kids, what's it like to have a sister with Down syndrome? And she just straight away said, awesome. And I just thought, oh, that just says it all.
Did you know before Lucy was born that you were having a child with Down syndrome?
No, I didn't know before she was born. I had chosen not to have early scans, and then the 19-week scan didn't reveal any issues. And, so she was diagnosed at birth.
What was that like for you when you found that out? What kind of process did you go through?
Well, it was a pretty emotional time. It was hard. One of the things I remember saying was that I felt like I'd had a baby die and someone had given me a different one and just wanting the floor to swallow me up. But I think over the following days and weeks, and I got to know Lucy and got to understand more about Down syndrome, and understanding that even though I didn't know she had Down syndrome, that God knew all the time, that he had made her like that and loved her, and that he knew, was really helpful to me. Yeah, I think it was a long process of coming to terms with it, accepting it, and then learning and moving on.
Just explain to us what Down syndrome actually is. How does it affect Lucy physically and mentally?
Okay, well, it's a syndrome, which is a collection of traits. Its technical name is trisomy 21, so she has an extra chromosome on the 21st gene. What it means for Lucy, or for lots of people with Down syndrome physically, is physical characteristics. So some of them have different almondy-shaped eyes, a flattish kind of nose, a short stature. They often struggle with hypertonia, which is having low muscle tone. So that means that all of their muscles everywhere are more floppy than typical people, which makes it harder for them to sit, crawl, move, walk, run, jump, climb, to talk as well. So, people with Down syndrome are more likely to have some different medical issues. They just have a higher risk of some things. And Lucy's had a few medical issues which have been a bit hard, but she's well, which is great. In terms of how it affects her mentally. Having Down syndrome usually means that you have some level of mental disability, of intellectual impairment, which make it harder for you to learn. They generally have a smaller short-term memory, which makes it hard to remember things. It can make it harder for her to concentrate for long periods of time, and organising her thoughts and motor planning is more difficult than for typical kids.
Okay, so what are the biggest challenges for you as the parent of a child with Down syndrome?
When Lizzie was born, someone really helpfully said to me, you know, what you need to do is to make a place for the disability in your family, but you also need to put the disability in its place. And I found that a really helpful thing, but in a way, one of the biggest challenges is working out how to do that and the balance between, you know, therapy and having fun, or Lucy's needs, if they compete with her sister's needs, and just that balance in life, I suppose. I think sometimes it's a challenge to not get ahead of myself and to start worrying about what might happen in 20 years' time, and to keep focused on what's happening now. Sometimes it's frustrating and sad and hard to watch her struggle with learning and to just, you know, to grieve the fact that she can't seem to learn something that typical kids just, you know, pick up along the way. That can be really hard. That ongoing grief. There's grief at the beginning or when you're diagnosed, but that's not the end of it. You know, there's ongoing grief as you watch other children grow and you watch your own child not reaching milestones that other kids seem to effortlessly attain. So that's a challenge. And you just want to know that you're doing the right thing. But there's lots of books out there and there's lots of encouragement and help, but the end of the day, you just want to know you're doing the right thing. But then I suppose over all that, one of the biggest challenges as a Christian and is to actually really keep the important thing. And, you know, if I really value whether Lucy follows Jesus and loves him and knows him more than anything else, whether she can thread beads on a string or she can write beautifully or speak beautifully, then, you know, how is that reflected in what I do with her and how I care for her.
Do you get support from the government and the community in raising Lucy, and what could be done better?
There is support available. Lucy's been entitled to what's called the Better Start funding, which has given us some money to put towards things like speech therapy and occupational therapy. She's been having early intervention through a service since she was 3 weeks old, which has been really great. We've had fantastic medical help. We've had a fair bit to do with the Children's Hospital at Westmead and they've been wonderful. We've had awesome support from her preschool, her local preschool, which has just been wonderful. They've been wonderfully welcoming and caring of her. We're now moving towards school, and so that's a little bit scary because, as I understand, the funding is unlikely to be really sufficient for her in the mainstream schools. I'm committed to giving mainstream a go and trying to make that work, but I am worried that she might not get the support that she really needs to make that work for everybody and for all the benefits that all the research says is there to really come to life for Lucy.
Now, if there's someone listening who's just had a high-risk scan or who's just discovered that their baby has Down syndrome, what would be your message to them?
You'll be okay. Yeah, your baby's a precious gift and yeah, God knows them and knows you and what you all need. For all the challenges of raising a little person with a disability, oh, you know, Lucy's awesome. She is awesome, and it's awesome having her in our family, and she's great fun, and she's got a great sense of humour, and she cuts some mean dance moves. She knows lots and lots of songs. She loves people. She's very empathetic. I remember someone saying to me a long time ago, oh, Liz, she lights you up, or you light up when she's around. And I know that I do, and I've watched how other people light up when she's around. So for all the challenges, there's heaps of joy. She's great to have around. And, yeah, when she does achieve milestones, it's like the high that you get. You know, when all your kids learn things, it's great, but when you see the struggle of a child to learn something and when they conquer it, it's just unbelievable. It's you know, I was sobbing the other day because she wrote her name for the first time and it was just fantastic. So yeah, these little people come to us and yeah, we don't know. They will change you. They will impact you. It will be hard, but yeah, there's great joy and blessing in parenting little people like Lucy.
It was Lucy's birthday today. How old did she turn?
She turned 5.
And in the 5 years that you've had Lucy, what would you say that you've learned or how have you changed from the experience?
Oh, I think I've probably changed a lot. I think I've really learnt to trust God and know that I'm not in control. I've learned to trust there's a plan, even when I can't see it and don't understand it. And I've learned more the need and the benefit of being thankful. I've been stretched and challenged to do things that are hard or that I feel uncomfortable to do. Yeah, to stand up for Lucy and for my other children, but particularly for Lucy, where she really needs me to, even if I feel uncomfortable. But yeah, I think at the end of the day, it's to trust God every step.
That is Liz. She's the mum of 4 kids, including Lucy, who has Down syndrome. And we had a chat on Lucy's 5th birthday.
For around 2,000 years, Christians have lived in the Iraqi city of Nineveh. Today, it's called Mosul and has been taken over by the militant extremist group ISIS. 2 weeks ago, the Christians of Mosul were presented with an ultimatum: convert to Islam, pay a protection tax, or leave. Greg Clark is the CEO of the Bible Society and he knows more about what's going on. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Katrina.
Can you tell us more about what's actually happening in Iraq right now?
It's an awful situation, really, where one group of people is being entirely persecuted, and in this case, it's the Christians of Iraq. You've described it well. They've been given an ultimatum by a group called ISIS, which is fighting for an Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. Basically, it's pack up and leave or live in a state of what they call dimitude, which means you are a second-class citizen and you run the risk of being killed. And so really, I think we've basically vacated Iraq as far as Christians are concerned.
Okay, where have they gone to, Greg?
They've fled across the borders in various directions, and we know that thousands of families are basically refugees in the neighbouring countries. There are some parts in the north of Iraq that are still safe, but we've got a huge humanitarian crisis, and it's a particular kind of crisis where this Christian group is being persecuted for their faith. And I'm just desperate that we do something to help them.
Do you know much about how the Christians of the area have been responding to the situation?
Well, there is a Bible Society in Iraq, and that's the connection we have. And they've been working hard to care for a number of years, actually, to care for families who are in trouble with aid packages, with medicine and food and hygiene items, and also supplying scriptures. And in particular, they provide children's Bibles so that the kids who are in these Christian families have a chance to hear their stories of hope. So there's plenty of work to do, but we're trying to reach out to about 3,000 of these families with some support at this great time of crisis.
Okay. Is there anything that we can do to support Iraqi Christians?
Sure. We'd love you to kick in on this project if you could. At the Bible Society website, biblesociety.org.au, you can contribute to the campaign to get these packages of aid material, Bibles and children's Bibles to about 3,000 Iraqi families. Your gift of around $30 will help one family of about 5 people to survive for a week in terms of food and hygiene, and also give scriptures to the adults and the kids of the family. So if we can just do that, at least we'll be demonstrating that we're in solidarity with Christians in need.
And what about on a more long-term basis? Is there any hope for Christians to return to that area that they've lived in for so long?
I think that's a very difficult question to answer. The aim of the group ISIS is to establish Islamic states where they go, and they are expanding. I heard recently they've moved into Lebanon as well. It really is a disastrous situation for those who aren't Muslims. There doesn't appear to be much hope at all, actually, of being able to live together in peace. Instead, they're really looking for new homelands, which is an awful, awful situation to be in when you think that, as you said, for about 2,000 years there, we've had witness to Christ in those communities, in these very ancient places. Nineveh is mentioned in the Bible. It's literally just on the river across from Mosul. They're sort of adjoining cities. It's where Jonah went to preach to the Ninevites and bring them the message of God's grace. And now we're seeing these people being driven out for precisely their beliefs.
Why is ISIS gaining so much ground?
It is a long and complicated question, that one. But there's obviously been a religious conflict in this part of the world for a very long time, and it's partly an internal battle between Sunni and Shiite Muslims as to how Islam should be practiced. This group ISIS thinks that other Muslims have put up with opposition to the Prophet for too long, and it's time for them to make right as they see it. So they are going out throughout the city there, painting the Arabic letter N for Nazarene on all the houses of the Christians to ensure that they are dealt with. And this might be why you see on your Facebook pages at the moment a lot of Christian people have chosen the letter, the Arabic letter that looks a bit like a smiley face, as their profile picture to stand in solidarity with the Christians there who are suffering. In this part of the world, your life is on the line now if you're a follower of Jesus.
Well, thanks for letting us all know about it, Greg.
Thanks for the support, Katrina, and we really appreciate all the people who kick in and help us.
Okay, it's Greg Clark. He's the CEO of the Bible Society. To show your support, visit biblesociety.org.au/Nineveh. You can also find out more on their Facebook or Twitter. Still to come in the Hope Mornings Weekly podcast, we'll hear from TV newsreader Suzanne Lattimore from Sky News about her 10-year-old son's fight with cancer, and Ben McKechnie reviews And So It Goes. Today, we carry the world in our pockets. We can call, text, update our status and access any number of games, songs, apps and TV shows at any time. But how is this influencing our spiritual lives? Filmmaker Craig Detweiler is director of the Center for Entertainment, Media and Culture at Pepperdine University in Malibu. His latest book is called iGods, How Technology Shapes Our Spiritual and Social Lives. And he's in Australia for the Spark Creative Conference that was on over the weekend. Hi, Craig.
Hello, Katrina.
How are you coping with our chilly winter?
I'm completely adjusted. It's actually a nice break from the heat in California.
So. Okay, that's good. What's now influential in our culture, Hollywood or Google?
Well, certainly a decade ago, it would have been Hollywood, but now I find that we are so attached to our cell phones that we are always looking at Google or Facebook or Twitter. And I think we're aware when we're watching a movie or a show, but technology slipped into our lives so seamlessly that we don't really question whether maybe Google has given us the best answer. We don't even think about how a Google search may have given us a false expectation about how long a search should take. You know, when Jesus talked about asking, seeking, and knocking, I don't think he meant for nanoseconds.
Yeah, you're right. I guess we're used to having an answer just pop up on our screen now. Maybe that's made us less persistent about spiritual matters.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, I wrote the book because I felt like, you know, we've sort of trained ourselves to look down to our smartphones rather than up to God. And even though these devices are meant to serve us, they often end up kind of driving our day, where we feel we must respond to a text, you know, immediately. So something that was designed to make us more organized, I, when I look at my students and even my own life, it sort of ends up making us feel more harried and hassled and stressed out.
Yeah, and what are some other impacts that technology has on our spiritual life?
Well, you know, I often wonder, you know, is having the smartphone, does it make me more patient? Does it make me more loving? Does it make me more kind?
Hmm.
You know, those are the virtues that I want to sort of, you know, cultivate. And yet, you know, the core virtues of technology, I think, are speed and efficiency. And you think about Jesus' life, and there wasn't a lot of speed involved, and there was often maybe a lot of inefficiency. The disciples are saying, why are you going there? And Jesus is saying, hey, just trust me on this. You know, we're going to take the long road. We're going to take the slow road, and we're going to find God along the way. And we've maybe squeezed out God of those quiet moments in our life by just always defaulting to, you know, checking our updates and sending out the latest news about us.
I think it's easy to see how technology can threaten the virtue of patience. But the other ones you mentioned were things like love and kindness. What kind of influence does technology have on that?
Well, I don't think we've really thought consciously and carefully about how to love someone in the digital domain. You know, what does digital discipleship mean? How do you love someone via Facebook? How do you care for someone via Twitter? Those technologies themselves actually encourage us to think about ourselves first. They literally ask us, you know, what are you doing? What are you thinking? How do you, what's up with your status? And so how do we turn that that coding, that software around and say, how do I love or care for others? and not just sort of treat my friends as an audience for my updates, but how do I, you know, kind of get back to, you know, a cup of cold water? How do you send a virtual hug? Maybe you have to sort of turn that phone off and actually go over to someone's house and sit with them and rediscover those ancient virtues.
Yeah. Do you have any suggestions for how Christians can be more intentional about how much we let our lives be controlled or influenced by technology? Are there any little practical tips that you've got in your book?
Well, I certainly wrote the book, iGods, as a parent as well as an educator. And one of the assignments I have in the class is I actually force students to turn off all of their electronic devices for 24 hours. And they kind of freak out. They say, I can't do this. This is impossible. And yet, maybe even 4 or 5 hours in, they feel remarkably, you know, far more relaxed. So I think taking an electronic Sabbath, whether that is as a family, you know, on a Sunday, whether it's over the dinner table, you know, to rediscover that there's an off button on these devices and that you can, in a sense, take control or take power back from these things and be much more intentional face-to-face with people, particularly with those that we care about who are closest to us, to not just be satisfied with texting our parents, but to actually be face-to-face with them.
I mean, quiet moments seems like another really obvious way of reconnecting with God and with people around us, I guess, when our phones tend to keep every moment kind of filled and noisy, don't they?
Mm-hmm. And you think about how many times it's the still small voice, right, where God enters, you know, that we've kind of removed Psalm 46 of being still and knowing that I'm God. It's just not a it's not on the agenda. It's not on the to-do list. Mm. So I think we have to be, yeah, a little more conscious about that.
Okay. Well, thanks for the reminder, Craig. It was good to talk to you this morning.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's filmmaker Craig Detweiler. He's the author of iGods, How Technology Shapes Our Spiritual and Social Lives. Suzanne Lattimore is a television newsreader and mum of two who was living a fairly normal suburban life for most of 2013. But the week before Christmas, her son was diagnosed with an enormous, very rare and highly malignant tumour. It was the start of a long journey and many hours spent at Westmead Children's Hospital. Suzanne never expected to be the mum of a child with cancer, but since Manning has recovered, she's taken some time to reflect on what she's learnt through the experience, and she's been kind enough to come in today. Hi, Suzanne.
Hi, Katrina. Thanks for having me.
What's it like to be back in this building, hey? Your first job was just up the road at Blacktown Guardian and later right here.
Yeah, a lot has changed, but a lot has stayed the same. The technology's moved on, but the building's very much as I remember.
Now, you were living a pretty normal kind of working mum existence before you found out that Manning was sick. When did you first realise something was wrong?
Manning came to me in the night and he said, Mum, my chest hurts when I lie down. Can we prop some pillows up? And red flag straight away. I know in my mind, I thought to myself, what if it's cancer? Which sounds crazy, but I immediately knew it was something highly unusual. He'd had a bit of a cough, he'd had some antibiotics, and when he said my chest hurts, I thought, no, that's not okay. So we went for an x-ray, and there it was. There was a huge mass. The radiologist called us back immediately for a CT and an ultrasound and advised us that afternoon to walk across the road to Hornsby Hospital. We were admitted through emergency. And we pretty much didn't see the outside world for about 3 months after that.
That's huge. And so you started on chemotherapy almost straight away. What was life
like
then?
Yes, we went through that process of a biopsy. We started on chemo just before Christmas. And that's a terrible thing. Very quickly, they lose so much weight. They lose their hair. They look like sick children. They look like cancer patients. It's a very, very difficult thing for parents to have to go through. And the worst thing for us was that actually the chemo didn't help. So after 4 rounds of chemo, it was clear the tumour wasn't shrinking. And the next course of action was radiotherapy. That was probably our darkest day. The radiotherapist told us he would have scarring on his heart. He might require medication for the rest of his life. His spine would have to be radiated and he wouldn't grow as he should. He might grow crooked and his growth would be stunted. I knew that his life was on the line, but I wasn't prepared for those consequences. That hit me really hard. And I asked her, would he be able to ride a bike afterwards? And she said, I hope so. And I thought, oh, this is really scary. we didn't want radiotherapy. And we were scheduled to start that on the Monday. The Friday before, we had some advice from a consultant in LA come in just in time, and he said, we think you should do surgery first.
This was a very large mass, and it wasn't exactly clear where the edges of it were. Surgery must have had risks of its own.
Absolutely. The big talk. They had a bypass machine on standby for the surgery in case the tumour was touching his heart and they needed to patch that. He could have been paraplegic. There's so many things that could have gone wrong. In the end, nothing went wrong. It was, I believe, a miracle. The surgeon got the tumour out intact. It was the size of a rock melon. Inside his chest.
That's incredible.
He had to take out three ribs, and Manning has basically one lung left. But with that, he got clear margins in a space where there just weren't any margins at all. We didn't know that for some days after the surgery. But when he told us that news, really, we couldn't hardly believe that he'd managed that.
Yeah, that is amazing. How was Manning when he woke up from the surgery?
Full of tubes and puffy. He had a piece of tape on his chest that said, no bones, don't touch, where they'd removed the ribs. He very quickly came to, and we were by the bedside, and he gave a little fist pump, and we understood that he was celebrating the fact that he was alive. And he waved my iPad over, and he could barely see, but he was trying to type on the iPad, and he managed to type, and I still have this in my file. He wrote, I did it, all one word, no spaces, and then he wrote, I love you.
Oh, that's amazing. Must have been really hard on him for a kid to go through this at such a young age.
Katrina, I really think he had prepared that he might not survive. The day before the surgery, we had a little party with cousins in the hospital, and he was running around as best he could and sort of trying to play. And my husband said, he's doing that for us so that we have that memory of him. And he told us he was taking pictures in his mind in case he didn't wake up. It was an incredibly brave thing to witness. And I think he's certainly matured a lot in a very short space of time.
Yeah, it's a lot for a kid to go through. How's Manning going now?
He's very well. We're hoping he's off to school camp next week. As far as we know, the cancer has gone, and he's had his first post-op scan that showed everything looked okay. So now we're just in that zone of waiting for 3 monthly scans and feeling very grateful and very hopeful that he is actually through his treatment and we can start to move on.
And so what have you learnt from all this?
I think not to be afraid, because as much as we all know as people that that bad things can happen and eventually we all die, we know that, but we don't understand it. But once you understand it, I think you can live with less fear, because all we have is today and the love that's around us, our family, our friends, our community. And we've learnt just how much we are loved, which is really a beautiful gift.
Oh, that's very special. Well, it's great to hear that you did feel that you received a lot of love and support. Has that made you want to give something back?
Very much so. And a lot of people around us are fundraising. I've also been approached by Red Kite, and I've recently become an ambassador for them. And I'd like to let anybody listening know that if they have a family member, 0 to 24, or know of somebody who does, who is undergoing cancer treatment, they should go to Red Kite's website. Red Kite can offer them financial help, whether it's petrol for the car, if you've got to travel to the hospital, or paying some bills. Red Kite's really wanting to get the message out there. Don't wait until you've exhausted all of your financial resources, because there is some help that you can get. So check it out.
Oh, that's good to know. Thank you, Suzanne.
Katrina, thanks.
That's Suzanne Lattimore from Sky News talking about her son's battle with cancer. In just a moment, we'll hear from Suzanne's sister, Belinda, who's been on a journey of her own with this. I've been speaking with Sky News presenter Suzanne Lattimore about her 10-year-old son's battle with cancer. In response to that, her sister Belinda and two other women are setting off on an ambitious journey. Three girls, 3 days,
300 Ks. Welcome, Belinda.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Now, tell us what you're going to do.
Well, myself, Jane Thornley and Natalie Wittenberg are riding from Sydney to Foster.
Fantastic. Now, have you ever done anything like this before?
Never. I have never done anything like this before. Jane has ridden for the Lighthouse for the Chris O'Brien Foundation before, but the three of us are still quite novices to cycling.
So this is a big challenge.
It's a very big challenge. It's a very big challenge for us. Yes.
So what's motivating you to do it?
Well, the motivations obviously come from my nephew having gone through a really significant battle, you know, in the past 6 months. And when you see somebody that you love going through that and there's nothing that you can actually do to fix them, you can't be the person to make them better. You try and fix on something that you can do and you do something positive. And that's where the motivation came, was that I saw a need and I saw something that I could do. And I enlisted my two friends to help me and they were really keen, jumped on board, and that was the beginning.
And what are you raising money for?
So what we're raising money for is the parents' facilities of the oncology ward at Westmead Children's Hospital. So it's called Camperdown Ward. And the parents, when they go in with their sick children, they can be there for months, literally living with their children next to the bed for months. And the dining room, lounge and bathrooms are just very dated, very tired looking. And I just really felt that, you know, that's something that we could do, is to support the families who are supporting their kids.
Mm. Yeah. And how's the fundraising going so far?
Well, I'm just so overwhelmed with the generosity that we've had. Our target was $5,000 and we're almost at $7,500 already, and we still have a week to go before our ride starts. And we're just very, very excited and overwhelmed. It's been fantastic.
Well, we're going to have a quick chat with you at the end of the ride and see how you went. But if people want to support you and make a donation, how can they do that?
Yeah, we'd love people to visit our website at Everyday Hero, and it's 3 girls, 3 days, 300 Ks.
Okay, fantastic. Thanks for telling us about it today, Belinda.
Thank you.
That's Belinda Lattimore, one of 3 girls riding 300 Ks in 3 days. You can find their fundraising page on Everyday Hero. It's called 3 girls, 3 days, 300 Ks. All the money raised will go towards upgrading the cancer ward at Westmead Children's Hospital.
From the director of The Bucket List.
Would you like to do this yourself?
Only if you do it wrong.
I'm going to make someone a great wife someday.
And When Harry Met Sally comes a comedy.
Take that box, put it on that box, it's on that box.
Are you a hoarder?
About friendship.
I'm the only friend you've got.
Might have found somebody else who likes me, so you can die now.
Family.
Now, what is your favorite color for your room?
Purple.
Is this some pathetic attempt at flirtation?
Well, when you put it that way,
Hope 103.2 Mornings with Katrina Rowe.
The Culture Collective.
It's one of the best movies I've seen for ages.
Really fun series, but it's got a great underlying message.
Guaranteed 8 out of 10.
Since The Bridges of Madison County was such a big hit back in 95, movie makers have been producing romances aimed at slightly older audiences. Movies like Quartet and The Best Exotic Marigold Hotel. And So It Goes, starring Michael Douglas and Diane Keaton, is the latest Hollywood movie about romance later in life. Our film reviewer, Ben McKechnie, is on the line. He's been to see it. G'day, Ben.
Top of the morning to you.
Now, this is directed by Rob Reiner, who is responsible for some of my all-time favourite movies, things like The Princess Bride, Stand By Me, When Harry Met Sally. Does this movie live up to that high standard?
No, it doesn't, Katrina. I'm sorry to be the bearer of bad tidings. It is amazing. I also after seeing this movie, went back and had a look at all the movies that Rob Reiner had made, and he also made This Is Spinal Tap and A Few Good Men. This man has made some incredible movies. Maybe later in life he's slowing down a little bit, maybe not picking projects as well as he used to. I'm trying to give him generous reasons why he might have made And So It Goes. And in comparison to a movie like When Harry Met Sally, which is a fantastic film, as you well know, about the way men and women relate to each other, And So It Goes doesn't quite hit those high points of discussing men and women.
And so what's the movie really about, Ben?
Well, it stars Michael Douglas and Diane Keaton, which on paper sounds great. Like, I really like those guys. They too, a bit like Rob Reiner, haven't done as well later in their career as they did earlier. But having them together on screen is, you know, that's nice. It's enticing. Michael Douglas plays a real estate agent who's looking to retire. He's trying to sell his house, which is this massive $8.6 million mansion that he's trying to get rid of. at the same time, he lives next door to Diane Keaton. They bicker a little bit, you know, that kind of, they bicker, that's what they do. And then Michael Douglas's character has an estranged son. His son is was a former drug abuser. The son turns up and dumps his daughter, so Michael Douglas's granddaughter, on his front step and says, "You've got to take care of her for a while. I'm off to jail."
Wow.
That's what kind of kicks along, and so it goes.
Well, Michael Douglas's character, Oren Little, seems pretty unlikable. Does that make it hard to care about what really happens to him?
Yes. It's one of those movies where they've tried so hard to make the main character, as you said, unlikable, that he is unlikable. And so it really takes a lot for you to even get close to liking the guy. And even when his granddaughter, who he hasn't met before, when his granddaughter shows up, yeah, he's still very prickly and doesn't want much to do with her. And it's Diane Keaton's character, Leah, the next-door neighbour, that ends up taking the granddaughter in and spending a lot of time with her early on. So Oren and Leah have these exchanges, and the way they talk to each other early on, you know, some of it's meant to be funny, but a lot of it is just really grouchy and rude and that kind of thing. So they're trying to drag humour out of that, and for the most part, me and my wife, Amy, didn't find it that funny. A lot of it you just sort of don't like the guy increasingly. But I'd say if you've seen the trailers for this and even the brief, like, snapshot I just gave of, you know, this guy's kind of grouchy and his granddaughter turns up, you should be able to predict where this movie is going. I think the title is very representative, and so it goes. It does what you think it's going to do.
All right. And is there any good message in the film or anything that you could take out of it?
Well, yeah, there is. So when Amy and I walked out of the cinema, we weren't, as you might be able to tell, we weren't huge fans of the movie. But there are a lot of parts of it where both of us were quite struck by some of the things the characters do or say. And we wished that the movie had gone on in those different directions. So it felt for me, I don't know if you can think of movies like this yourself, but you know, where you watch a movie and you think, wow, I think there's a really good movie in here. They just haven't made it on this occasion. So, I wish I was watching that movie. For example, there's some bits and pieces told to us about Oren and Leah's past. Both of them, their husband and a wife has died, and how they dealt with that grief. That comes up at times, but they just sort of just push it to one side and then move on to some, you know, someone falls over on a slippery slide or you know, his kids make bark like dogs, you know, like these kind of cheesy jokes that get chucked in when there's real substance in what's going on. You know, the son turns up who's not only estranged, but he's a reforming junkie, and he's got this daughter and he's off to prison. All of these kind of things happen, but they just kind of float by as this movie doesn't really dig into the depths that could have come out of that.
Okay.
So it's actually got a lot to say about people trying to find companionship and meaning later in their life that they think can come from a relationship. And So It Goes definitely has that in there. It just doesn't present it as strongly, as meaningfully as you'd like.
All right. Well, thanks, Ben, for filling us in.
That's all right. My pleasure.
That's film reviewer Ben McKechnie. We've been talking about And So It Goes. It stars Michael Douglas and Diane Keaton.
Thanks for listening. Start your day with life words. Subscribe to Hope 1032's free daily email devotional at hope1032.com.au.